Yeah, so in a nutshell, that was my background, is that I had sort of this long-term plan of becoming a missionary to the Islamic world, and that was the direction that I was heading to. In fact, my background is Assembly of God, and so shortly after coming to faith, does Assembly of God still have the, do they still sort of network with Wycliffe? They used to sort of be in partnership in terms of missions. And so a lot of the assemblies would sort of be Assembly slash Wycliffe. But there was a fellow that had come to the church that I was going to at the time, an AG in South Shore, Massachusetts, Brockton Assembly of God. And he was a missionary in Kazakhstan. And so he started sharing. And so now, this is probably 1991, maybe early 92. And I was still a new believer, and I had never heard of the concepts of the 1040 window. So, he's explaining the 1040 window, which is, essentially this section of the world that is in the greatest need of the gospel. And yet, and of course, it's dominated by Islam, that, what, I don't know the longitude, latitude, exactly which is which. And so here is the greatest need in the earth in terms of the people that need the gospel, and yet it's the least. We're sending the least amount of missionaries. So we're sending an average of one missionary to every 500,000 Muslims. So imagine, imagine the number of churches, if on a Sunday you got up and you had, the opportunity, if you were living, wherever, you had the opportunity to go to, Dallas, Boston, or Montreal, or, to go to church, the, in terms of the percentage of an effective gospel witness in some of these areas. Obviously, others have older established churches that are functioning. And so, as I heard all this, and he was also sharing in Kazakhstan, an incredible amount of poverty. And so he was sharing about, like lepers and ministering. I was like, lepers? I didn't know they still had lepers, and. And so, in any case, as he shared this, I guess I would say I felt the call. And that night, I went to the altar and I said, "Yes, Lord. If the Islamic world is where the greatest need is, then I'm offering myself." And so, thus began the, I guess the 5-year plan that we have, or the 5 or 10 year plan, where I was giving myself to that. Well, long story short, I was starting to go to Bible school. I had moved to the Midwest. I was going to go to a couple years to a school. Wanted to sort of learn the things of the Spirit, and then I was going to go up to Bethany College of Missions, which is in Minneapolis at the time, and sort of complete my 4 years in missions, and then go to the Middle East. Well, after the first year of school, my teacher was this Jewish teacher, brilliant guy, speaks several languages. I think he spoke like English, French, Hebrew, German, even a bit of Yiddish, and some Russian. I mean, it's one of these. And so he really turned me on to the Israel centricity of the scriptures. And all of a sudden, again, this is all fairly fresh to me. And so what I ended up doing was actually just moving to the Middle East. And it's a long story. I'll tell a brief story because it's funny. Is there anybody here, like, it's either from South Africa or has a friend from South Africa? No. South Africans are intense. Like, I've never met a South African that wasn't pretty intense. So I intended, initially we were supposed to go to Israel for about 6 weeks. This was just supposed to be sort of a little trip. And the first night that we got there, this guy sits down with me and he's like, he's just super intense. He's like, "How can you say that you believe in this God, that you trust this God, you trust him with your life, your eternal salvation, all of these things, you trust him for this, if you've never stepped out and done it?" And I was like, "You're right!" And so the next day I canceled my plane ticket, my return ticket back home, and in order to do that, it cost $250. Well, that was my spending money. $250 was all I had. So I canceled my plane ticket, and I had just enough money to basically get a ticket back when I wanted, but now I had no money, and I'm just there, and I'm trusting God, yeah! And so basically just, kind of really, trusting the Lord. What it amounted to was that I went down after several weeks, I spent some time in Jerusalem. I ended up going down to Eilat, which is the city right on the border of Egypt and Jordan, and essentially rented my body to a construction company, which there, you know, 6 days a week. We worked 12 to 14-hour days. It was about 115 degrees average during that season. And basically it was, okay, you see this pile of block, you move this cement from here to here, you know, and it's like, that pile of cement, you mix it in the street, and you know, and it was like heavy construction, you know, it was just like concrete block, and just like, move the 1,000 block from here to here. And, you know, again, 115 degrees, and I was making the equivalent of, at the time it was 12 shekels, so it was the equivalent of $3 an hour. And so I sympathize, you know, when I go to, you know, Home Depot in the morning and the illegal workers, I was the illegal worker, which I didn't think of at the time, and I was working illegally, stepping out in faith, trusting God. And well, what's funny is then at the end of the year, I came back and my teacher, he says, well, what have you been doing, you know? And I said, well, I was in Israel, I stepped out, I trust God. He said, well, how'd you survive? I said, well, I worked. He looks at me and goes, you mean you stole jobs from Jews and worked illegally? And I was just like so deflated, you know. I was like, I trusted God, he provided, you know. I even got a muscle. In any case, so that was kind of how the whole thing started. I came home, and then long story short, when I was there, when I was, you know, laboring, I kind of determined, Lord, maybe it would be best for me to not just get a degree in missions, but actually get a degree. And so I was going to go home and get a degree in engineering. That was sort of the change in the five-year plan, in order that I could eventually move to the Middle East with a tent-making career, so to speak. And so I was going to pursue irrigation and this sort of thing. Well, you know, we have our five-year plans, but then what happened is what I say life happened, which is I met this young woman who became my wife, but, you know, it was, we met, we dated for 3 months, got engaged, 3 months later we're married, 4 months later we're pregnant. You know, all of a sudden you're like, what just happened? You know, like you wake up, you're like, I was just single a few months ago, now, and so life happened. And then actually what happened after that, as soon as my wife got pregnant, she sort of had a lot of residual, she had a lot of lifelong medical issues that sort of just blossomed after the first pregnancy, and she's really had an incredible amount of difficulties with a lot of different issues since then. But it became very apparent, a combination of her medical issues and me being a newly married guy, coming to terms with my own immaturity, and so I was just like, there's no way that we can raise a family in the Middle East. It wasn't going to happen. So throughout the rest of, let's say, the 90s, now we're probably in the late 90s, and then coming to the turn of the century, I continued to reach out to Muslims. I fell in love with Muslims. The thing, when I first got saved, you know, being from South Boston, again, I was just, you know, basically a little drug-dealing drug addict. When I got saved, I was on fire, and for some reason, none of my drug buddies wanted to hang out with me anymore. And so, you know, it was really very lonely, and I felt like, you know, massive. I was like the only Christian in like the tri-state area, is what it felt like. It wasn't, not really, but I used to take a little New Testament and go into Boston on a Saturday, take the train in, and just walk around and just looking for targets. Use the word target, and I was like, no, I didn't target people, but, you know, walk around and just looking to share my faith. But what I discovered soon was that most Americans really don't like to talk about God, the Bible, or Jesus. You know, not like I like to talk about God, the Bible, or Jesus. But I soon started running into Muslims. And what I found out about Muslims is Muslims like to talk about God, the Bible, and Jesus. And I was like, you know, they're my theological enemies, but yet they're sort of like soulmates in that they love to argue about these things. And, you know, and I was like, I like these people. And the thing that I like about if they were actually from the Middle East or, you know, from an Eastern perspective or culture, is that in the United States, if you try to engage someone religiously, they're like, oh, quit shoving your opinions down my throat. You know, and there's sort of, this guy is pushy, he has bad vibes or whatever. Well, with the Middle East, you like you can argue and like have intense debates and exchange spittle on each other's face, you know. And then after like a few hours, it's like, okay, my friend, great talking. We'll do it next week, you know. And there's just no offense. It's just there's that close sort of, you know. And I was like, I love these people. So despite the fact that when the time came, I realized I wasn't going to be able to move to the Middle East, I've always had a passion. And so really for the next many years, there was just a lot of different capacities. I was volunteering for ministries or doing email correspondence and reaching out locally, just, you know, whatever. You just go to the gas station and start chatting with a guy and get together for coffee. And it was just always, you know, I just always had this love. Started a ministry at UMKC, and we were reaching out to the internationals, most of which were Muslims, and they would always be the ones that wanted to engage. Well, then what happened post 9/11? 9/11 happened, you know, obviously a big deal. And at the time, I was doing email correspondence, and you know, at the time, I was mostly just fielding questions, challenges, debates, whatever, from Muslims. And then all of a sudden 9/11 happened, and all of the questions started coming from Americans, and many of whom were Christians or nominal Christians or even Catholics, and many of them were considering converting to Islam. And you know, I was kind of like, what in the world is this? You know, and I was raised in Calvary Chapel, or I was raised, I mean, you know, people that you would, they were not just nominal borderline Christians, but some of them had been raised in the church. And they were like, well, after 9/11, I was interested in Islam, and I joined some online forum, and I started, and they were very nice, and they answered my questions, and I went to the mosque, and now I'm, you know, about to convert, but I wanted to know what you would say about this, you know, and I just, and many of us that were doing this sort of thing were experiencing this, and it was just, I mean, it was unfathomable to me. You know, but up until that point, to me, Islam, I just sort of viewed it as just one more false religion out of many false religions. Like, you know, you've got Hinduism, Islam, you know, Buddhism or whatever. Islam's just the largest. But it was during that time that I really started, and they were slipping through our hands, you know, and I think that, or at least I thought that I'm fairly gifted at being able to give very good answers. You know, I was always able to respond in a loving but firm and documented manner and provide the answers. And I was like, this is a solid answer. But there was just a seductive spirit behind a lot of it. So we're seeing all these Westerners converting to Islam. Not always, but there was a lot. I mean, there was a lot. There was actually a Pentecostal pastor during that time that converted, that had been a pastor for years, and I was just like, what in the world is this? So it was during this time that I really began discerning that Islam is more than just a false belief system. And of course, when you're, you know, dialoguing slash arguing with Muslims, and again, I'm kind of, I can be a fighty guy, that I was like, I'm not, you know, not going to lose an argument, you know, to this. And some of these guys are incredibly well-educated, I mean, amazingly intelligent. I had this argument that went on with this one guy for over a year. He's from Indonesia. He, same thing, spoke several languages. And he had gotten his master's degree. Specifically, his whole focus was on the history, the development of the canon of the scriptures, the biblical scriptures. You know, how many Christians here are thoroughly educated in the development of the canon of Scripture? And, you know, and he wanted to, you know, so we're arguing about the early church fathers and the different canons that were used. And, you know, and I've got my big stack of books, and I'm not going to lose an argument, but this guy's far more, you know, educated than me. And this sort of thing went on for years. But it was around that time when, you know, and I went through a couple-year depression during this time. I mean, it was just, you know, and the only way I can describe it, and this may be, you know, graphic, but to convey the emotion of what I was experiencing, seeing Christians, whether legitimate or not, and however you view that, converting to Islam, is imagine if, you know, all of a sudden one of your parents or your children announced to you that they're going to have a sex change operation. And you're just like, there's just something just fundamentally just wrong and perverted about that. To see a Christian, to me, converting to Islam, it felt like watching people commit spiritual suicide. right in front of me. I mean, I just had this sick feeling. It was during this time that I also started studying the stack of books that would, my poor wife, every bathroom in my house has like books, and because that's where I do a lot of my studying. But I'm in the bathroom. I know the kids are screaming. I'll be out in a minute. No, just kidding. But the stack of books started becoming Islamic eschatology. So I started becoming interested in what do Muslims teach about the end of the world. And so many of the things that I was discerning as I was seeing Christians convert to Islam started to become confirmed as I was studying what Muslims and what the Islamic sacred traditions teach with regard to the end of the age. And, you know, it was sort of just like this whole world opened up to me. And my wife's very gracious, so, you know, there's sort of this endless stream of books coming to the door from Amazon and all these rare Islamic bookstores and so forth. And since that time, you know, I don't remember exactly at the time when I was studying. I think there was probably about 20 or so books that I could find that had been translated into English, written by Muslims. Now there's well over 50. I mean, just in the Islamic world, the interest in these subjects has exploded. And so I want to share with you tonight essentially the result of my studies, which became the book that's back there, Islamic Antichrist, a comparative analysis of biblical and Islamic eschatology or beliefs about the end of the age. So it's a, you know, it's a strange topic to discuss in a church service, but there's it's an interesting enough subject to look at. And then there are some definite lessons that we can take away from this. So the first character that we need to be familiar with within Islamic end time belief is known as the Mahdi. We, in English, you can just say Mahdi, but Mahdi. And this is Islam's primary Messiah figure. Okay, so our primary Messiah figure, of course, is Jesus. They have a guy called the Mahdi. And so this is from a book by Sheikh Mohammed Hisham Kabbani. He was the sort of, he's from Canada. His title was something like the Supreme, I forget what it was, the Islamic Council of North America, the Supreme Sheikh, or I forget, some sort of, puffed up title. But in his book, The Approach of Armageddon in Islamic Perspective, he says this. He says, after the lesser signs of the hour appear and increase. Now, Islam divides up their end time beliefs between what are called the lesser signs and the greater signs. Lesser signs are what we would sort of equate to the birth pangs, sort of the preliminary signs of the end times. He says, after those signs increase, mankind will have reached a stage of great suffering. Then the awaited Mahdi will appear. He says, the coming of the Mahdi is established doctrine for both Sunni, that's the majority sect, and Shiite Muslims, indeed for all humanity. And, you know, you can go online now. Back then, that was around 2003, 2004, it was very hard to find anything online. There was very little online about the subject. Now you can go everywhere. Artistic rendition here, this is the Kaaba in Mecca, and, you know, all the Muslims are celebrating the coming of this anointed one. And what's that at his feet? Oh, a sword. Well, that's unusual. So two recent polls conducted by the Pew Research Forum have given us profound insight into the percentage of expectations among Muslims concerning the coming of the Mahdi. So the question that was asked is, do you believe the return of the Mahdi is imminent in your lifetime? So not just do you believe in the Mahdi, but do you believe that it's imminent in your lifetime? That was the question they asked. And they asked, I think, 23 different countries. And it was a high number. I mean, it was like tens of thousands of people were interviewed. And so here are the percentages. Afghanistan, 83% said they believe that he will come in their lifetime. I mean, that's a tremendously high number. Now, what's interesting as sort of just a side observation is, let me see if I press these both, is if you notice, the top two are the two countries that the United States has been at war with. And you know, you have to say, is there a reason that those two nations have such a high expectation? Is it something about war that stirs up apocalyptic expectation? But 72% in Iraq, and then 68, that's a high percentage in Turkey. That one shocked a lot of people. And then you can, you know, see all the different numbers. Overall, when you average it all out, it was close to 50%, a little bit under 50% was the average. Now, again, this is not, do you believe in the man? You know, like asking a Christian, do you believe Jesus will return? Do you believe Jesus will return in your lifetime? And almost half of those polled said yes. That shocked everybody. Most people thought it would be a small margin. And I've been critiqued over the years by different people saying, oh, Sunnis don't believe in this, only the Shia. You know, and it's completely not true. This is really, the Sunnis and the Shia, they have some slight variations in what they believe about these things, but it's really taught and widely held throughout the Islamic world. And then the second question here was, do you believe in the return of the Mahdi? So this is just simply, do you believe in this guy? He's the guided one. So in Arabic, the word Mahdi is like sort of the guided one or the awaited one, which would draw out, which in Arabic is the Yahdi. Am I saying that right? Yahdi is, he draws out that which was hidden, and he sort of reveals that. So it's sort of a play on words. And he will initiate the final period before the day of resurrection and judgment. So do you believe in him? Now, these were mostly African nations. Again, you can look at the numbers, almost 60%, 72, 60, 74. These, of course, are Muslims that they're asking. But an incredibly high percentage throughout Africa, most of which much more Sunni than Shia throughout Africa. So, you know, again, just to emphasize, this is a widely held belief throughout the Islamic world. Now, what do they believe about the Mahdi? Who is he? So first of all, he will be a universal leader, a caliph. The Sunnis would call him a caliph or a khilafa, and or an imam. The Shia would call him an imam for all Muslims. And so this is from the Hadith collection. Hadith basically are the extra Quranic Islamic sacred traditions. So they have the Quran, and then they have the Hadith. The Quran is the word supposedly of Allah, and then the Hadith supposedly are the words of Muhammad, okay? So they're not quite as sacred as the Quran, but almost. And they have these various collections, one of which is Ibn Majah. So Muhammad said, if you see him, go and give him your allegiance, even if you have to crawl over ice, because he is the vice regent of Allah, the Mahdi. From another collection, Sunan, that's basically the collection of Abu David. He will pave the way for and establish the government or the Ummah, the family of Muhammad. Every believer will be obligated to support him. He will be, according to their traditions, the ruler of the world. This is from an author from India in his book on the end times. He says, the Mahdi will establish right and justice in the world and eliminate evil and corruption. He will fight against the enemies of the Muslims who would be victorious. This is from a couple of Iranian authors. Do you remember during the Iraq War, there was Muqtada al-Sadr, was the young guy that we were always contending with. Well, this is his uncle, Bakir al-Sadr, Ayatollah Bakir al-Sadr, and another fellow, Mutahiri. So they say, he will reappear on the appointed day, and then he will fight against the forces of evil. He will lead a world revolution and set up, now this is my George Bush Senior imitation, a new world order based on justice, righteousness, and virtue. So many of my jokes are inside, but you know the quote where everyone's righteousness and virtue. Ultimately, the righteous will take the world administration in their hands, and Islam will be victorious over all the religions. So again, you know, you look at the pictures that are, his face is always covered, that are, you know, sort of just these amazingly grandiose pictures that are portrayed of the coming of the Mahdi. This is a Shia depiction. And according to their traditions, the Mehdi will gather a coalition of nations from the Middle East to conquer Jerusalem, from which he will rule the world. This is from the Hadith collection of Tirmidhi. Armies carrying black flags will come from Khorasan. Khorasan is a region that straddles the borders of Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, sort of that north east quarter of Iran. Armies carrying black flags will come from the east, from Khorasan. No power will be able to stop them until they reach Beitul Maqdas. This is the holy house in Jerusalem. It's a reference to Jerusalem, where they will erect their flags. So they come, this army comes from the east, and they set up the flags. You've seen the black flags. Every time there's an Al-Qaeda video, it has the Shahad, it's black, and in white letters it has the Islamic creed written across it. Sometimes it has this little circle, which is the seal of Muhammad. Sometimes it'll have two cross swords. They put it behind guys as they do the beheading videos. Don't ever watch those, by the way. Give you brain damage. And so then here's, you know, again, an artistic rendition of the Mehdi coming to establish, plant the flag of Islam, the leadership of Islam over the earth from Jerusalem. Both Al-Qaeda and Iran, okay, Al-Qaeda is Sunni, or obviously the Iranian mullahs are Shia. They have both produced videos portraying their followers, their armies, as that army coming from the east. So Iran portrays themselves as the army that's going to come and conquer Jerusalem, and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban have produced videos where they're on their horses with swords and flags and all of the kind of Islamic, you know, rah-rah music to try to recruit, you know, young folks. And, you know, try to imagine, by the way, why would they go join the jihad? And this might be a little bit more difficult for women to relate to, maybe, but, you know, think of the pride and the honor that comes when a young man is recruited to join the military, particularly like after 9/11, when the whole national spirit is behind going to stand up for America and all of these things. And then combine that with the sort of the pride and the calling of going to Bible college and to go to ministry. And it's sort of a combination. They're going to join the holy war for God. And it's an incredibly macho appeal. And some of the videos that they create, you know, it's incredibly seductive. And, don't watch this either because it's filled with profanity. But there was just this video, and it's kind of funny, but of these two gangbangers from, like, South L.A., and they're in Syria. And they went to just go join the jihad, and actually they're fighting on behalf of Assad. And, it surfaced because these guys posted on their Facebook. But, you know, they're like, you know, here's these guys. They're like, ASA, homies, we're on the front lines in the Middle East, yo. You know, look at over there. And, you know, they got AK-47s, and they're like, look at the enemigos. But, you know, it's just like there's this allure to go join the fight, to go join this. You know, from all over the world, they probably have no understanding what in the world they're even fighting for, but there's just that allure of the excitement, the battle. But when you combine that with the call of God on these young men, and, you know, believe me, when you argue with them and you're discussing theology, they approach theology like it's, you know, like it's a wrestling match, you know, like with all the male bravado that you can muster. Now, the point in reviewing all of this material, who is the Mehdi, is to simply say that when you look at their expectations of their primary Messiah figure, he bears a striking resemblance to our Antichrist. Okay, so the Antichrist, of course, will also set his seat of authority in Jerusalem, according to the scriptures. 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 4 says of the Antichrist, he will oppose and will exalt himself over everything that is called God or is worshipped, so that he sets himself up in God's temple. So the temple, of course, in Jerusalem. Matthew 24, verse 16 says, when you see standing in the holy place, that's the temple, the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. So there's this clearly prophesied event where the Antichrist establishes himself specifically on the Temple Mount, in the rebuilt temple, which is yet to be rebuilt, And Jesus says, when you see this, flee. And it's just, you know, it's amazing that, you know, the Bible says this is what the Antichrist would do. And then over here you have the Islamic traditions which say this is what Muslims say, this is what our Messiah, our Mehdi figure will come and do. The Mehdi will also engage in a Jewish genocide. This is from the Hadith collection of Sahih Muslim. The Prophet said, the last hour would not come unless the Muslims will fight against the Jews and the Muslims would kill them, until the Jews would hide themselves behind a stone or a tree. And then the stone or the tree would say, Muslim, or some of the alternate translations say, Abdullah, servant of Allah, there is a Jew behind me, come and kill him. Come and kill him. Now, I mean, you look at this and you say, today, for instance, people will often say, well, if it wasn't for Israel, really the Muslims wouldn't be upset. If there was no state of Israel, they would really be fine. But the fact of the matter is that this tradition was, you know, inspired or whatever, and written down and recorded at a time when there was no state of Israel. Well, why were the early Muslims determined to someday in Israel literally wipe out Jews until there's only a few left hiding themselves behind a tree or a rock? Who inspired this? Where did this inspiration come from? You have to have the discernment of a log not to see the satanic hand that is in, that is clear and apparent in some of the development and the early evolution of some of these Islamic traditions. That's demonic. That's from the pit of hell. And by the way, this tradition is part of the charter of Hamas. And so in terms of the ongoing political conflict, you know, you have all these people say, well, Israel is so unjust and so unfair and they should just make peace with the Palestinians. And then Israel says, well, here's one precondition. You have to renounce this hadith. And Hamas says, never. That's our eternal destiny. This is what Allah has called us to do. And can imagine, this was in your constitution. You know, this is the founding document of Hamas. And then the Jews go, yeah, because, you know, you're saying this is part of your constitution, we don't think peace is really possible. And then the world says, Israel, you guys are so stubborn. You're so irrational. You know what I'm saying? I mean, how can you make peace with someone who has sworn and believes it's their divinely destined, prophesied destiny to wipe you out? You know, it's irrational, and this pressure is put on Israel to, you know, and usually what they'll say, and, you know, I hear a lot of these guys, these Western, you know, leftists and so forth, they're just like, oh, yeah, that's in their charter, but nobody really pays attention to that. It's really not a big deal. You guys are making more out of it than's necessary. Well, then they should renounce it and take it out of their charter, but they refuse to, and that's been an issue behind the scenes for many years. This is from a book that's written by two Egyptians called The Mehdi, The Awaited One. The Mehdi will be victorious and eradicate those pigs and dogs. As the Hadith states, Jerusalem will be the location of the rightly guided caliphate, that's the Islamic government, the center of Islamic rule, which will be headed by Imam al-Mehdi. That will abolish the leadership of the Jews. And some of you may even remember, trying to think, what was the guy's name? Hegazi? He was sort of he was Morsi's sort of guy he was the sheikh that was giving all the speeches before Morsi come in, and they were up there chanting. This was, you know, now maybe 2 years ago, and he was saying, Cairo is not the capital of Egypt, but Jerusalem is going to be our capital, and we will march to Jerusalem, martyrs by the millions. And they're all chanting, Shuhada, you know, the martyrs, we're going to go and take Jerusalem, Al-Quds. Did you see that video? Do you remember that? You know, and this is part of the Muslim Brotherhood culture, their expectations. The Mehdi, according to Islamic traditions, will rule specifically for a period of 7 years. Again, Sunan Abu Dawood, the Mehdi will fill the earth with equity and justice as it was filled with oppression and tyranny. He will rule for 7 years. Now, there are some traditions that say, because there's many, many traditions, and some that say he could rule for as much as 8 or 9, but then all of the scholars say, but most agree it'll probably be 7. And when I was in Jerusalem, and I interviewed Ikrima Said Sabri. All these issues is what I interviewed him about, and he just went down the list and just confirmed, yeah, the Mehdi will rule 7 years, and you know, he was just confirming all of these things. So I've got, you know, an excellent interview of him really laying all these things out. Now, of course, the biblical Antichrist also is said to rule for 7 years. Daniel 9:27, it says, the Antichrist will confirm a covenant with many for one Shabua. A Shabua is essentially a Sabbath cycle of years. So you have a Sabbath cycle of days, that's a week, and then you have a Sabbath cycle of years as well, and that's a 7-year period. But in the middle of the Shabua, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. That's the abomination that causes desolation. And on a wing of the temple, he sets up the abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. So it's a 7-year period that he is really his sort of his career. In the middle is when he really begins his sort of reign of terror. So that is the Mehdi according to Islamic expectations. Now, Muslims also have a secondary figure that they're expecting, and that is the one they call Isa. And so they also, Muslims, are expecting the return of Jesus. Now, what's funny about this is you'll get all these guys, and they'll be like, yeah, you know, Muslims, man, did you know they believe in the return of Jesus just like us? You know, and it's like, that's awesome, and, you know, they're just like us, you know. But what they don't discuss are the specifics that Muslims are expecting when Jesus returns, because it's not like what we expect. And so we need to look at that as well. So according to the Islamic Hadith, when Jesus returns, these are the primary things he will do. He will break crosses worldwide, globally. He's said to rid the world of crosses because this is to inform the Christians that Jesus, when he was here on the earth, according to Muslims, he never died on a cross. That never happened. No, Allah raised him up to heaven. He never suffered. That instead Allah tricked everyone and put sort of the image of someone else on the cross and tricked even the disciples, apparently, because Allah is the trickiest one, according to the Quran. And so Jesus will come back and basically tell the Christians, listen, you guys, I was never, you know, a Christian. All the things that you believe are not true. Your Bible has been thoroughly corrupted. It's a distortion. I was a Muslim. And now that I've come back, I've come to tell you that Islam is the true religion. It also says that he will kill pigs, and this is to inform Christians that you shouldn't be eating swine flesh, you know, because that's not it's not halal, or it's not kosher, and so you shouldn't be eating bacon. That's when the rebellion's happening on my side, I'll tell you what. He will abolish the jizya. Now, the jizya is the tax that, according to Islamic jurisprudence throughout history, when Muslims conquer an area, they extract the jizya tax from the subjected peoples. They're called dhimmis. And basically what this was just a source of revenue. But it's really no different than, you know, New York City, mafia, back whenever. And they come in and they're like, you know, hey, you know, I see that your little bakery's doing well. Well, you know, we're just going to come and collect some money each week, you know. And they're like, for what? Protection. Protection from what? You never know. You know, kind of like, you know, in other words, you're going to pay us to protect us from you. And that's basically what this is. It's this humiliating situation where they're supposed to actually have this public gathering where they kneel down in the public square, and then this sort of town leader among the Muslims would literally whack you on the head with a stick to signify that you're humiliated, and then you give the jizya tax, and now you're protected, and you're going to be covered and taken care of. Now, that was always allowed, so in other words, Christians and Jews could live as dhimmis, as subjected peoples, under Islamic rule, but according to the traditions, when Jesus comes back, that's no longer an option. It's convert to Islam or die. The jizya tax has been abolished. And then, of course, he is said to kill the false Jewish Messiah, and we're going to talk more about that, and then he'll follow the Mehdi. So the traditions actually say that Jesus comes back, and he prays behind the Mehdi to signify that the Mehdi is the leader, and he's secondary, and then he's going to tell the Christians of the world to follow the Mehdi. This is according to their traditions. Now, of course, I don't know if I have anything in there. In the Bible, in Revelation 13, you have the Antichrist, and you also have a character called the False Prophet. And the False Prophet is said to work miracles, and he's said to cause all the peoples of the earth to basically submit to or worship the Antichrist. That's his role in the biblical narrative, and it's amazing how Jesus sort of fills that role in this sort of anti-parallel world of Islamic eschatology. Now, the same polls ask, do you believe Jesus will return in your lifetime? So again, very, very high percentages, pretty much, you know, well over, you know, you get 65, 70%. That's, you know, a clear majority. Some of them are a little bit less. Then the third character within Islamic expectation is Ad-Dajjal. So this is basically their version of the Antichrist, Al-Masih, Al-Dajjal, or Ad-Dajjal Al-Masih, the charlatan Messiah. And so, you know, he's always portrayed as the Jewish king, the false Jewish Messiah. There's actually a few different books that have the same title, different authors, but the same title, The Emergence of Dajjal, the Jewish King. And according to Islamic tradition, this is what their Antichrist comes back to do, or will fulfill. He comes back and he claims to be God. He claims to be divine. He will specifically claim to be Jesus. So Muslims have two Jesuses that come back. One is the real Muslim Jesus. The other one is the fake Jewish Jesus, the false claimant. And he specifically is said to heal many people. He will raise people from the dead. And he will be the greatest deceiver that Muslims have ever faced. Now, whenever you read these books about Dajjal, I mean, they're kind of fixated on him. And they say, this will be the greatest trial that has ever come to the Muslims. The al-fitan, the greatest fitna, the challenge that they will ever face. And they have these traditions which say that a Muslim will go to sleep as a faithful, devout Muslim, but he will wake up a follower of Ad-Dajjal, a follower of the fake Jesus, the Antichrist. And it's interesting, the traditions say specifically he will primarily be followed by the Jews, and actually some of the traditions say he will be followed mostly by Jews and women. You know, surely, because, and some of them even say, because they are deficient in intelligence. It literally says that. I don't agree with that, just to be clear. They are superior in every way. And then the Antichrist will be killed by the Mahdi and Jesus. So that's sort of a rundown of their expectations. So here's a quote, this tradition. So the prophet said, before the hour comes, there will be a tribulation. That's the fitna. Like patches of dark night, a man will wake up a believer, so he gets up in the morning and he's a Muslim, and he will go to sleep as a kafir, an unbeliever. A man will go to sleep a believer, and he wakes up a kafir, an unbeliever. So they're saying the deception, the darkness will be so thick that during that time Muslims will be converting, just like from one day to one night to the morning, they're converting to be unbelievers. Now, here's what's so interesting about that. I played this video for you earlier, but how many were not here earlier today? There's only a few. I'll play it again, because this is such a great video. But so you have Muslims throughout the Islamic world converting, many through divine dreams and revelations of the Lord Jesus appearing to them. And so the irony is, here's the Islamic tradition saying, you know, the fake Jesus is going to be converting Muslims, and that the fitna is going to be so thick, the darkness, that Muslims will be waking up as an unbeliever. And literally, the real Jesus is appearing to Muslims throughout the earth, and they're converting. So this is just one example. I forgot I had this in.
So we go see a man who's come to Christ. We're like, how'd you come to Christ? He says, well, let me tell you what happened. One night I was sleeping, and a man knocks on my door, and he comes in. He's wearing all white, long hair. He was very, very powerful presence. His presence was very powerful. And the man told him this, write this down. So he wrote it down. And then we're like, what was it that you wrote down? He showed me his book. this man in a village. Nowhere near church, nowhere near a house group movement, nothing. And in his book, this was written, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word became flesh. And he wrote the whole book of John verbatim. This man told him the whole book of John verbatim. And I have pictures of this. And that's awesome. That's so awesome that God is alive, you know.
I'll skip that. So, he's an underground Iranian pastor. And I see it as the Lord's divine sense of humor. That you have the Islamic traditions that say the Antichrist is going to be deceiving people. And then here's Jesus actually divinely leading Muslims and appearing at night in dreams and visions. And they're not only coming, Muslims are not only coming to faith through dreams and visions, but it's a significant way. And when you think about this, by the way, how many people here got saved because Jesus appeared to them? Jesus appeared to you? In a dream, really? So there's a couple. Well, I'm jealous, is the point. I had some guy screaming at me, and I was like, oh my gosh, if I don't repent, I'm going to hell. But that's a special thing, that the Lord, essentially goes out of his way. And so you go, well, what does that mean? What does that say about Muslims? I think that means that God loves Muslims. And there's devout Muslims, and he's revealing himself to them because they're sincere. When they bow down 5 times a day and they say, Allah, guide me to the straight path, they may be praying essentially to a false god of the Quran, but there's only one God. And he hears the cry of the pagans. He hears the cry of everyone. And so he knows their heart, and, he shows up. He's showing up throughout the Islam. I think that's a sign that God is... there's a favorable outlook on many of the sincere Muslims, and so we need to continue to pray into that. It's an amazing thing that he's doing in our time. Here's a very revealing quote. This was a guy named Osama Abdallah. He was this sort of low-level online Muslim apologist that I don't even know if he's still active. He used to be very active. Way back when, but he said this, and he's laying out the difference between what Muslims believe about Jesus and what we believe. And he says, we believe that Jesus will come down to earth toward the end of the world time to fight the army of Satan, which will be mostly from the bad Jews, or the Zionist Jews, in other words, the Israelis, as we call them today, and the deceived polytheistic Christians, or the Trinitarian Christians, in other words, the Orthodox Christians, not the Jehovah's Witnesses. Apparently, the Jehovah's Witnesses will be fine. But the Israelis and Christians, Jesus comes back to fight us and to kill us, basically. And we're following the army of Satan, of course. The army of Satan will be led by a person who will claim to be Jesus Christ. The Muslims will call him the Dajjal, or the deceiver. The real Jesus' army will fight the Dajjal's army and defeat him. The empire of Israel will fall. The religion of Islam will prevail. Where's the empire of Israel? Anyway, it's like you look at the Middle East and it's like, where's Israel? Oh, there it is. The empire of Israel will fall. But they believe Israel controls the whole world. And, there's just abundant conspiracies there. But it's just amazing when you look at that and you go, okay, so their traditions have set them up to literally believe that when the Antichrist comes, he's their Messiah. When Jesus comes, he's the Antichrist. I mean, it's just, again, you have to have the discernment of a log not to recognize the pattern, the hand, the satanic hand in the midst of this. And, of course, these things all don't line up just perfectly. But you can look at it and you can say, okay, God loves Muslims. God loves many Muslims. But yet these people have been set up. They have been set up. I mean, you can imagine, for me, 19, I was a skeptical, I'd been raised nominally Catholic. I was really a hedonist. It was a big deal for me to come to faith and convert. Can you imagine having been raised under these traditions that you believe are, 1,200, 1,300 years old, whatever, 1,400 years old, and all of these things, and many of their prophecies essentially are coming to pass. I was talking to a guy that works with Somali believers up in Minnesota, and he had sort of the leader of this whole tribe come in to his class that he was teaching on how to reach out to Muslims, and he just had him share about Islam. And then they did the Q&A, and they said, beyond everything, what convinces you that Islam is true? And, you know, he had all of his intellectual reasons, and they go, no, but really at a heart level, what convinces you? And he said, you wanted me to be honest? He said, what convinces me is that all the prophecies are coming to pass. Israel is back in the land. You know, this is lining up. And the war in Syria, by the way, all, and I didn't deal with this in the video, but, and I'll just say this, but you have beyond the Mahdi, beyond Jesus, beyond the Dajjal, and I don't even write about this in the book because it gets too complicated. They also have another secondary sort of antichrist figure. They call him the Sufiani. So he's kind of this preliminary guy that comes just before the coming of the Mahdi, and he's the Sufiani, and he comes out of Syria. Now, all of the Sunni fighters, the Al-Qaeda guys, ISIS, the Islamic State of Syria and Iraq, they believe that Assad is the Sufiani. And then all of Assad's guys believe that Al-Qaeda is the army of the Sufiani. And if you go online, even in English things, you can see them talking about this like crazy. They're discussing it and debating it. But I asked Adnan Oktar, the folks there in Turkey, and I said, what do you think? And they said, yeah, Bashar is the Sufiani. So they're one of the biggest, and this is not really being discussed in the mainstream media at all, but one of the most significant driving factors in drawing these young jihadis into that conflict, they believe it's the beginning of the eschatological battles. You know, their prophecy said that this guy would come out of that region just before the coming of the Mahdi. To them, the prophecies are lining up. I mean, the point is Muslims have been set up. Satan, you know, who understands the prophecies of the scriptures, he comes, here's a young man who's in a cave and he's fasting and he's praying, and he comes and, you know, you read the Islamic traditions, Muhammad's in the cave, this thing comes on him, according to his own account, chokes him to where he feels like he's going to die, demands of him, Iqra, recite, you know, and he says, I don't know how to recite, and it three times it's choking the life out of him. Finally, the words of the Quran begin flowing out of him. You know, and again, if you understand biblical revelation, you understand when the angels come, it's not just this dark presence that chokes you to where you're terrified, you feel like you're going to die. Muhammad was suicidal and believed he was demon-possessed for the next like couple weeks until his wife, Khadijah, convinced him that he was a prophet. No, you're not demon-possessed, you're a prophet. Just go with it, you know. And that was literally the beginning of Islam, the beginning of the Quran. So Satan somehow gets in, and he gets into a young guy that was orphaned and, you know, has obviously all sorts of issues, and he convinces him he's a prophet. He opens himself up, and he allows Satan to begin speaking through him. And then, at, you know, 1,400 years later, you have these traditions where this largest percentage of the world, you know, has these traditions which have set them up. And they may, many of them are sincere, you know, whatever, but they're prepared by Satan to be on the wrong side. You know, so it's like the end times, we always kind of go, well, you know, just sort of like in the last days, suddenly some sort of new religion is just going to just come up out of nowhere and the whole world's going to sign up. You know, like, you know, how's that going to work? And we go, no, actually, Satan's been at this for 1,400 years. He's been systematically sowing his leaven throughout the earth, and his spidery tentacles are in every nation of the earth right now. He has his people everywhere, you know, and when the time comes, and that's not to say every Muslim is going to be on the wrong side. I believe the Lord has a great harvest that he's going to call out, and I believe there'll be even many Muslims that will resist these things. I believe there will be. There's many good-hearted people there that the Lord is drawing to himself, but the deception is set in place. Here's an amazing thing that I've always read this verse, and it just kind of blew me away because I just couldn't figure it out. So here you have the quintessential picture of the return of Jesus in Revelation 19. And it says, I saw heaven standing open. So here's, you know, when's the last time anyone's seen heaven standing open? And there before me was a white horse whose rider is called Faithful and True, and with justice he judges and he makes war. With eyes like blazing fire, the armies of heaven were following him, riding on white horses, dressed in fine linen. So, you know, he comes out of heaven, he's riding a horse, there's armies following him. Then I saw the beast and the kings of the earth and their armies. So now you have the Antichrist and the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against the rider on the horse and his army. And I've always read that and I've said, how idiotic are these guys? Heaven just opened. The rider comes out of heaven with the armies of heaven, and they're like, hey, let's go fight this guy. You know, you're just like, what type of deception? You know, is it just they're so hardened? You know, the Lord has hardened their heart? Until you understand Islamic traditions. And in fact, Islamic tradition says that when the Dajjal comes, the fake Jesus, he comes on a giant white donkey riding across the sky. It literally says that. So when Jesus comes back according to the biblical pattern, the kings of the earth that have been deceived by the Islamic traditions go to make war with him. They go to make war with him. But the beast was captured and the false prophet with him. The two of them were thrown alive into the fiery lake of burning sulfur. The rest of them that were killed with the sword that came out of the mouth of the rider on the horse, and all the birds gorged themselves on their flesh. In conclusion, what is our response to this information? And again, I understand this is unusual information to discuss, you know, in a church service. It's minimal on scripture and a lot on really demonic material, and it's not the type of thing that you want to dwell on. Jesus said this, Matthew 16, verse 3, he says, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And then he rebukes the Pharisees. He says, because you know, you guys know how to interpret the signs in the sky and in the earth. He says, but you are unable to interpret the signs of the times. And he actually rebuked them. Now, today, many people will essentially say, they'll say, you should study the Bible, but you shouldn't worry about what's taking place on the evening news. You know, they say that's newspaper eschatology, the sort of thing. Jesus basically rebuked the Pharisees for not being able to relate the biblical prophecies to the events in the earth, to the signs of the times, if you will. And, you know, this verse means a lot to me because, and I don't really understand, but growing up in Cape Cod, we always had the saying, red sky at night, sailor's delight, red sky at morning, sailor's warning. Does that work out here in Kentucky? Sort of. You know, because I'm like, because, you know, and then we also had the nor'easter. If there was a nor'easter, that was bad. And then in the Bible, you had Paul ran into a nor'easter. And I'm like, but if you're, you know, in San Diego, a nor'easter is probably not going to be the same thing. So it's just neat that my geography seemed to work with the biblical, you know, weather patterns. But, you know, we basically had that saying all the way back to the times of Jesus. And so Jesus expects us to understand the signs of the times. And so we need to understand, one, what the Lord is doing in the earth today among Muslims. But our response, if we have any heart at all, if we have any connection with the heart of God, in looking at this material, this should drive us to our knees. We need to say, Lord, you know, again, it's been over 20 years since I've come to faith, but I'm continually grateful that the Lord spared me. You know, the Lord began working on me. It wasn't really the night that I got saved, but a really good friend of mine, I mean, he actually lived with me for some years. We were supposed to go out this night. And last minute, I had a friend's dad that had been inviting me to a Bible study for years. You know, you guys should come. And, oh, yeah, I'm going to go. And just, you know, after years, for some reason, my buddy, we were supposed to go out. He was like 10 minutes late. Just last minute, I decided, I'm going to go to the Bible study tonight. I just blew my friend off and went to this Bible study. He got killed in a car wreck that night. You know, he rolled his truck multiple times. I would have been basically sitting in the back of his truck. I got shot when I was 13 with a BB gun in the chest. When you think, well, it's just a BB gun. This kid pumped it up like 15 times shot me point blank in the chest. Penetrated 5.5 inches at an angle. The BB right now is sitting at the crook of my aorta, my pulmonary artery, and resting against my heart. In any direction, a fraction of a centimeter, it would have ruptured my aorta, my pulmonary artery, or punctured my heart. You know, we all have the stories where the Lord spared us. But I'm just like, God, I was such, I mean, I still am such an idiot. But yet, for some reason, you called me. It's only by His grace. It wasn't like, I can't point to anything in my life where I'm like, yeah, I kind of deserved for you to save me. You know, like, it just doesn't work that way. And I'm like, God, these guys, they're praying 5 times a day. From the time that they're little, they're going through the religious rigmarole and all of the, you know, all of the effort. I'm like, God, have mercy on Muslims. You know, I love them. You know, again, we get in these arguments. I love their passion for God, but it's without understanding. And God, it was so hard for you to break into my life, and I can't imagine how hard it would be for a Muslim's heart to be open, but I know that you're fully able to do that. And we need to recognize what the Lord's doing in the earth in this time, and we need to apply ourselves, not just go out of here tonight and go, that was interesting, that was different, but really take some time and say, Father, you know, maybe you know Muslims or maybe you don't, but say, Lord, across the earth, I ask that you would continue to pour out your Spirit, to open their eyes, to do this thing in the earth, and again, to become, familiarize yourself with missionaries and those throughout, you know, the regions throughout the earth that are giving themselves to reaching out to Muslims. And in doing that, we're partnering with what God's doing in the earth. Come on up. Amen.
Yeah, this is all very sobering material, isn't it? But again, what should we be setting our hearts and our minds on? On the age